When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. When we got awesome special guest, Dr. Grant? Are you a PhD?
It is. It become PhDs. I know I'm talking to PhDs now.
Yeah, so. That's all right. Yeah, we're technically DOs. So. That's all right. So okay, that doesn't good. Count. Right.
No,
so it doesn't
bad.
Count, actually.
Re-record.
Yeah. No, so very good. Special guest. So reason I wanted to have him on. We get a lot of questions. We even get them in our Q&A. I think we get emails about this, about like, hey, what body fat scale should I have? What should I get? What should I do? DEXA? Should I do the BOD pod? All these different things. We have these we go to these conferences where we're trying to be sold on these in-body scales. And so Dr. Tinsley just published a really cool study looking at various home scales, at least of their accuracy and prediction of body composition, which is really probably the most practical thing, because most of our patients are asking us, you know, what kind of home scale should they get? And, you know, we kind of know a little bit about this, but you got really into, it's basically studied it. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got into the field that you're in, and we'll talk about your study in a second.
Yeah, no, first, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be chatting with you both. So yeah, in terms of my own background, I won't make this too long, but I'll go back to junior high
all right.
to start. Kind of my interest in fitness, nutrition, all these things started. It was right before I probably hit my growth spurt. So I was a little bit fluffier. And I had a friend who was just super ripped for a junior high boy. He did like whatever, 500 sit-ups a night and 500 push-ups a night. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. Like that. His body can look like that and my body can look like this. So ultimately, you know, then I grew up, you know, had my growth spurt, was very skinny at that point. My natural build would be very thin, actually. So I started getting into fitness and lifting to gain muscle. Didn't know what I was doing. Thankfully, I had a dad who had lifted. So he gave me some guidance. But, you know, I was joined Planet Fitness when I turned 16 before it had the, you know, stigma some people get nice. Today. And got kind of started on that fitness route. And I always loved science. I've been a nerd my whole life. So I started studying physiology and nutrition in my undergraduate work and learning about a lot about lifting just in the gym.
Where'd you go to school?
So I did my undergraduate work at Oklahoma State University.
Oh, Okie State.
Which I know as, yeah, so for some wrestlers, yeah. you know, another big wrestling
When were you there?
There. I was there from 2008 to 2012.
Oh, God darn, I'm old. Okay. Did you ever, let's see. Oh shoot. That was even after your
no,
time,
I just,
Spencer.
It was just after, yeah, but
I was
yeah,
at
Oakland
State a couple of times.
That, okay.
But that was between 99 and 2003.
Okay.
Oh, very yeah. cool.
Yeah. So then after I got the degrees in nutrition and physiology, I did a master's in biomedical sciences, which was largely anatomy and physiology. We did a lot of cadaver dissection, which definitely gave me a new appreciation for the human body. I really loved it. And from there, I finally got into some kind of exercise specific coursework. I did my PhD in kinesiology and exercise nutrition at Baylor University in Texas. And then right after finishing that, my PhD in 2016, I started as an assistant professor here at Texas Tech. So I'm now an associate professor, just kind of living the life, doing a lot of research related to body composition methodology. So like things we'll talk about today, quite a bit with sports nutrition and supplementation. And then some work with intermittent fasting and resistance training adaptations as well.
Sounds like you're gonna have to be on a few times in the future.
Yeah, we're just gonna get your expert. We're gonna mooch off your expertise here. Very cool. So what got you into the body? I mean, obviously you're into building muscle and losing fat, but then like specifically studying the devices that measure body. Yeah. How'd you get into that specific field?
My first interest was actually in my PhD program. I was working on a literature review on ketogenic diets. And one of the issues that came up was questions related to like if differences in glycogen storage and the associated water that you might see on a ketogenic diet could sort of trick body composition methods, where it might not be fair to compare, say, fat-free mass changes when someone's on a normal mixed diet and transitions to a ketogenic diet or transitions off a ketogenic diet. So that question kind of stuck in my head. In my dissertation project was actually the first one where I looked at this. So I looked at kind of an acute, very high carb and low carb diets where we provide all the food to participants, and looking at if we could kind of manipulate both DEXA, so dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, and bioimpedance, which we'll talk about today, kind of trick some of these devices. So that's kind of my first foray into that. And then since I've been here at Texas Tech, I really enjoy technology. I enjoy data analysis, and body composition research is a good way to get a lot of data and get exposed to a lot of technology. So we've done quite a bit here with 3D body scanners, this recent project on bioimpedance. And then we do a lot that's more focused on the research side, different research methodologies. But we do like to connect it to your average, you know, like person interested in fitness or weight loss or anything like that. So that's one reason we're really excited to do this study we're talking about today.
Now, I think I saw your paper about the differences in fat-free mass changes. Did you have a paper on that, or did you write something about that?
Yeah, with the ketogenic diet.
Yeah, a year ago, 2 years ago.
Right? It was a few years back.
Okay,
it was a little bit earlier on in my PhD program, but yeah.
And what were the findings from that? Glycogen changes on ketogenic diet, and I assume there's something.
I'll say this was long enough ago that I think there's been a lot of research that's come out since then. At the time, there were only a very small handful of studies in exercising individuals. In terms of the broader discussion, this was kind of a tangent off here, just kind of a caveat we noted that, you know, there are questions in this area related to such a low carbohydrate intake. Generally we'd see, like, say with, you know, say fasting as an example of super low carbohydrate intake, if someone's carrying that out over several days, we'd see the liver glycogen depleted fairly rapidly, like overnight and extending an overnight fast. The muscle glycogen though doesn't deplete as quickly and would be dependent on like if someone's exercising or not. So at that time there weren't enough in exercising populations to say too much about it. We just sort of noted it as an interesting question for future discussion.
Yeah, that's cool. Very cool. So, all right. So let's dive into the body composition stuff. Can you, you wrote a blog about this. It was really good. I know James Krieger, I don't know if you've seen, he had a whole series on this multiple years ago, which, you know, we actually didn't learn anything like this in med school. I think we had some a little bit in our obesity certifications, but you go over the different models of how you actually measure body composition. I'd love to kind of have a brief overview of all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the kind words. And I am familiar with James Krieger and his article series several years ago on those methods was definitely informative and interesting. So yeah, big picture, you know, body composition assessment, the reason why we're interested in this broadly is we're just trying to describe the body's mass. So beyond just viewing all body mass as equivalent, just stepping on the scale, seeing the weight, we're trying to understand the composition of that weight a little bit more. So all methods of body composition assessment will really be trying to split up body mass into more than just that one compartment for viewing all body mass together. So the vast majority of these devices, including all the at-home body fat scales that we'll discuss today, use what's called a two-compartment model. So we're just splitting all body mass into fat mass and fat-free mass. And fat-free mass is just everything else, everything that is not molecular fat. So that's including water, protein, mineral that's in your bones, mineral that's circulating in body fluids, glycogen, and so on. Those would be the major components. And of course, this is an estimation. You all know, I'm sure you did work with cadavers as well. Unless you're dissecting a cadaver, either physically or chemically, you can't truly know someone's body composition, you know, while they're alive. So all these methods, even the best methods in the laboratory, they're just an estimation. So there's some level of error involved. So kind of one of the questions with this line of research on the at-home body fat scales was, you know, is the error so large that you just shouldn't even use these? That it's worse to have this number than to not have
which
this
is a
number.
Big question, right? From us. You know, I mean, just to interject, Spencer, in my undergrad at Michigan State, I did exercise physiology, kinesiology. We did a lot of this. I mean, we did all the calipers, the underwater wing, bod pod, you know, DEXA stuff. Obviously, that was even before med school, and then before I did all the literature review for obesity guidelines. But again, this is a little different than our patients who have obesity, diabetes, to those who are a little bit more in the on the spectrum of fitness. So, but anyways.
No, absolutely. So, most methods anyone will have access to are these two compartment models. So, there's some good things about that. You're not viewing all body mass as just one thing. You know, we know this, like an athletic individual is their body mass index, which might be really useful for you all some clinically in like obesity treatment or maybe initial screening. That's not necessarily informative for, I'll say you all personally as people with like above average muscularity. So the two compartment model is limited in that for fat-free mass, we're just assuming that we know the proportion of water. So we're assuming about 73% of fat-free mass is water. We're making assumptions about the amount of protein, mineral, and so on. So in the lab, we can build more advanced models where we add additional compartments. So for example, in the body fat scale study we're discussing, our kind of reference or gold standard method is called the four compartment model. So like the name implies, we're splitting all of body mass into four compartments instead of just two. And those would be fat mass, water, bone mineral, and then what we call residual, which is just everything else that hasn't been stated already. So we still have kind of an everything else leftover category, but it's much smaller. And the biggest thing is pulling out water individually. That's really important when you're looking at fat-free mass. So that's the big advantage of moving from a two-compartment model up to a more advanced method.
And the more advanced methods are done how? Just to, for the listeners.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, there's some confusion on this because there's not like a machine that's the four compartment model machine and you know, you step in it and it does it all. Maybe they'll integrate some of these technologies someday, but yeah, you essentially do a series of tests. So for our four compartment model, we bring people in, we would do a DEXA scan to get their bone mineral. We would do a bod pod test to get their body volume. We would get their body mass from a calibrated scale. And then we assess total body water. And there are a few ways to do this. The best way takes hours and hours because it's a dilution technique where individuals would say, like, give a saliva sample, ingest this labeled water, and then you collect more samples over the course of hours. We opted for a more accessible technique, which is a spectroscopy technique. So it's in the realm of bioimpedance, but as opposed to most devices, it uses hundreds of different frequencies and uses mathematical modeling to predict volumes of body fluids. So it's a relatively well-accepted kind of surrogate for total body water. So those techniques together, those four techniques, we pull one variable from each of them. So again, bone mineral from DEXA, body volume from bod pod, our body mass, and then our body water from bioimpedance spectroscopy. And we plug each of those variables into a four compartment model equation that was developed back in the day with in vivo neutron analysis, which is a really cool technique, but I think it's only at like maybe 2 to 5 facilities in the world. So not really accessible, but thankfully we have this nice validated equation that came out of that. And that's what we'll
spend on our four compartment model. That sounds a little above our clinical pay grade.
That's amazing. That is really cool. So, so then with that, you're like, let's see what are these at home body fat scales are even accurate.
Yeah. So in terms of those scales, we, so for comparison, we included a about $15,000 research grade bioimpedance scale. And I'll stop there to say, I think bioimpedance does get a bad rap and some of it is totally legitimate, but you know, when we have devices that you can get for $20 and devices you can get for $25,000, it's understandable. There's kind of a spectrum in terms of how advanced these technologies are and how accurate they are. And we saw that even irrespective of price, we saw that.
Well, so I guess my first question then is how, and now we have to talk about accuracy versus precision, right? But how accurate was that really good device you had compared to the standard? Because I'll tell you, in 2015, I had to do the literature review for guidelines talking about how to diagnose obesity specifically. So again, a little bit different population, but, you know, anthropometrically. So BMI, waist circumference, waist to height, you know, clinical exam, and then different measures of body composition if there was really a question. And that's, you know, really it was, it still kind of came back to DEXA and stuff like that. And the bioelectric impedance was, you know, like you said, it kind of had a bad rap in my mind just on the literature review. Like I was like, this doesn't seem clinically beneficial for us. So how was it for you for the one, for the, at least the best one, the research grade one?
Yeah. So I will answer your question. I'm going to give like a couple points of background information first. So one thing about bioimpedance as a technology, and this was controlled for in our study, which is why I want to say this up front. It is more reliant on good pre-assessment standardization. So there's good data on this now. This has been an area we've looked into some. Methods like DEXA are a little more robust to people having exercise, having eaten, having fluid to drink, which is important, I would assume. You can let me know if this is true. Clinically, where you can't say, you know, for every patient, it's not like you can assess every patient after a 12-hour overnight fast and rest from exercise and all this. If you're assessing someone at 4 p.m. at a visit, you know, that in my mind may not be realistic. So I will say that some of what we see is kind of like best case scenario where we have people who have followed pretest guidelines and we've tried to be meticulous about all this. Mm-hmm. With that said, so we had our research grade device. Our consumer devices, the cost ranged from about $25 to $350. There were some devices in that consumer grade category, $25 to $350, that performed as well or better than our research grade device, which was informative to us, certainly. And some of the higher end of the consumer, you know, I don't know that every individual is willing to pay, you know, $300 for an at-home body fat scale, but there are some where I personally like this emerging category where they're kind of like high-end consumer devices where, you know, maybe you have a, you know, personal trainer facility, something that wants a little bit better device, but can't drop $10,000 on a, you know, research grade bioimpedance device. And the performance of some of them was surprisingly good. We did not expect any of them to perform as well as our research grade device. With all that said, as a category, there would still be some limitations. I would still rank DEXA overall above bioimpedance if I had to just do either or as a overall assessment.
Okay. All right. So tell us what are the best ones? Let's hear it.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll give, just a little bit of,
and how much money are you getting paid from these?
Yeah. So actually that's one thing I'm happy to share that, all the funding for this was really a labor of love, but, just from my own like Texas Tech research funds here. So none of these companies had any role in this study. We had the one research grade bioimpedance device and then 14 consumer grade devices that we bought, off Amazon. Hmm. Essentially we went and looked at bestsellers on Amazon. We also, I knew of a few companies like Tanita and Omron and Sika that are kind of, you know, big names in this area that we wanted to test their consumer devices. So
do you have to get permission from these companies to do this or you just do it? How does that work?
As far as I know, we didn't get permission.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah. It seems like you wouldn't.
And then you can, and you can name them in the studies. And
yeah. So, I mean, we just purchased them. So they, you know, didn't have knowledge that we were doing the study. We did pre-register the study protocol on clinicaltrials.gov. So
good.
You can check and all the devices we listed there, all the ones in the paper, none, you know, mysteriously dropped off or anything like that. So no, I don't know. I'm not sure how it'll be received. For some of these companies, this is, you know, if I were with the companies and looking at it, for some of the devices, I'd be like, oh, wow, this is great. Someone did a study that we probably should have funded and actually
looks
good.
Cool. That's cool.
For some of them with worse results, they might be the ones looking at like, hey, you know, is this allowed? But we just bought them ourselves and ran the study. So
that's awesome.
So we did. Yeah, we purchased a variety, tried to get kind of a spectrum of price points in that consumer grade range. We tried to get sort of best selling scales off Amazon. So this would be, you know, applicable to a wide range of people. And I want to acknowledge one of my doctoral candidates, Madeline Seidler, who's the first author on our peer reviewed publication. She was instrumental in this from day one. We've had great conversations. It's been a great learning experience from the initial idea through, you know, the study itself to analyzing the data, publishing this and so on. So I definitely want to acknowledge her. But once we had all these scales we're interested in, we wanted to recruit a fairly broad population. We wanted this to be applicable to as many people as possible. So we had 73 individuals with a really even split of males and females who performed the first phase of the study, which was a reliability testing of the scales in what we call cross-sectional validity, which would be the validity or say accuracy at one point in time. So for that, we brought people in. You know, we had all these scales sitting there. We performed the four compartment model. So everyone got their DEXA, their BOD pod, the total body water assessment and so on. But then we had a randomized order in which people would go through each of these scales, and we'd do duplicate assessments on each. So they'd step on the scale, use it as directed, step completely off the scale, and then step on and assess them again. So that would give us just a sense of the technical error of the device, just from, you know, differences in foot positioning or what it's detecting from one test to the next. And I'll say for that assessment, all the devices performed very well, which should be expected, I think. The caveat is that if you're tracking someone over time, there'll be little things that are different about their body. Even if they do an overnight fast from, you know, food and fluid, even if they've seen from exercise and so on, there'll be something that's different that will impact electrical flow, whether that's body fluids, glycogen, electrolytes, you know, so on. So really what we're getting is just purely the technical error of the device, but there's some component of biological error that might not be reflective of a true body composition change. That's still there. So that's why I'll get to this later, but have a longitudinal component where we actually checked the performance of these over time.
Yeah.
So we got the reliability. Just one interesting side note, overall, the error was low. So what we call the precision error is one of the metrics we used. It was from like 0 to 0.5% in terms of the error of getting on, getting off, getting back on. But one thing we noticed is there were about five devices that had suspiciously high reliability to the point where you looked at it and it looks like they must have some type of restriction in the algorithm where it will not let body fat values vary in a given individual if assessments are performed within a certain amount of time.
So almost cheating.
They're almost cheating. And well, yeah, I guess it depends on how you view it. We talk about this a little bit in the paper, but it might be that they're trying to improve the consumer perception of the accuracy. It might be they're protecting consumers against themselves so that they're not like, oh, let me check my body fat all throughout the day and see how it's changing. So it could be warranted, but we wanted to note that in our rankings, we gave a little bit of a penalty for the reliability of those devices because it became clear they were not really treating the two assessments independently. So we couldn't truly assess the reliability of those devices. Huh. Yeah, it was, raised eyebrows. We looked at it like, this performance is too good to be real. But
how can you say real quick how these bioimpedance devices work? I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that.
Okay. So,
all of these devices use what are called contact electrodes. So if you've seen an at-home body fat scale, it'll look like a scale and have some little silver plates on it. Those are the contact electrodes. So those metal plates are in touch with surface of the skin. Many of these, about 10 of these, were what we call foot-to-foot devices. So it's just like a standalone scale. These electrodes are only contacting your feet. From there, some of those electrodes are injecting electrodes. So they will send a small imperceptible current into your body. And then other electrodes are sensing electrodes. So they will receive back the current once it's circulated in your body. And based on what the device knows it injected into you and what it received, it's really estimating the resistance to electrical flow.
So then the question
is,
is it better to give or to receive?
Yeah, so the device gives the current and receives it back, and whatever, you keep a little bit of it
back.
It's
like Spencer.
But no, the...
Hey-o.
Sorry.
Yeah, so the... No, you're good. You're good. So, you know, the greater... the kind of theory behind this is tissues with more water will conduct the current more easily, so they'll have lower resistance to that electrical flow. Whereas, say, adipose tissue with a much higher percentage of fat content as compared to like skeletal muscle, it'll resist the electrical flow more. So just based on that resistance to electrical flow, you can kind of, through a series of equations, estimate body composition. So from, you know, conceptually, you go from the actual bioelectrical data it collects to something like body fluids, estimating body water. From there, making some assumptions like we talked about with the two-compartment model, to predict, say, body fat percentage overall. So that's the big picture of how the technology works. So again, 10 of those just had the foot-to-foot electrodes. We had, I believe, three consumer grades, and then one of our, let me think about that. Yeah, one of our laboratory one that had hand and foot electrodes. So this is getting a little bit of a more comprehensive look at the body in that it's injecting and receiving currents both through the hands and the feet. And then for good measure, we did include, I don't know if I'm sure you all have seen the little handheld, looks kind of like a video game controller.
Yeah.
We included that. We just had it sitting around the lab and, you know, we like to joke about it, but we included that as well as a hand-to-hand one. That's really just creating a circuit through kind of the arms and torso.
Good.
Very cool. All right. So let's hear it. What was the best one? Which one are we going to go by right now?
So, you know, whether or not you buy any, we tried to give lots of caveats, even though, you know, we did provide rankings saying what we think are the best. I'm happy to discuss those. We try to provide some caveats saying this is not, you know, there's still enough error for all these devices that they should be interpreted cautiously. They shouldn't be the standalone metric, you know, so we recommend, and we talk about best practices in the paper. I recommend tracking other things, whether it's body mass, circumferences, relevant clinical markers.
Well, I guess then, should we start with how the research grade one compared to the standard, the four compartment model that you did? So, because does that give us a good baseline, or am I like...
It could, yeah. So it was in, it's good for comparison. It was in the top group of devices, but it was also clustered in there with devices that were much,
but I guess
much
how far
cheaper
off
than
and
it.
How would you, you know, how, like how, what was its error, I guess, accuracy error, if you can put it into clinical.
Yeah. So I'll start
clinical, but you know what I mean? Layman's terms.
Yeah. Yep. So I'll go, I'll answer that kind of going back to, so we did the reliability assessment from that same one visit assessment. We could answer the question we're talking about now, which is just how close were body fat estimates at one point in time to our four compartment model. There are a bunch of different metrics used, and we performed all of them. We provided a sort of, honestly, in the manuscript, it's kind of simplified, but we provided supplemental materials with tables and tables of all these metrics. Cause we want every metric, you know, like a researcher or clinician, if they're looking for that one metric, we wanted them all available. With that said, if you hear about body composition methods and someone throws out, oh, this has a 3% error or 2% error, often people are talking about a metric called the standard error of the estimate. So it's a decent, you know, if you're trying to just describe the percent error device, it's a decent metric. So for context, the range of standard errors of the estimate we saw was from about 3% to 7.5%. So again, if you've, you know, whatever, heard DEXA in some context having a 2% error, 1.5% error or something on body composition assessments, the range here again, 3% to about 7.5%. The research grade device was, and I can pull up the exact one here so I don't tell you wrong, it was on the better end of that spectrum. Making sure
so
I'm pulling up.
If somebody has a 10% body fat according to the gold standard, are you saying that the 3% would mean they could be somewhere?
It could be 7 to 13%, even though it says 10%. Is that what you mean?
Is that what you're saying? Or is this a different?
No, that is one way you can interpret it. It's a slight simplification, but I think it's a worthwhile one because it's not too important, I don't think, for most people to go off into the weeds further than that. But that would be a great way to do it. So if someone gets that, that 10% body fat on a method with a standard error, that's about 3%. It's still not like 100% certain that's between 7 and 13, but you can feel confident that it's probably between those values.
Okay. Very good.
So our research grade device was, just above 3.3%. It was at 3.2% for the standard error, the estimate. But there were several other consumer grade devices that were right around 3% also. Then the worst consumer devices were up around, 7.5%. So, I mean, you get a body fat percentage of 10 and you're between, 2.5, which, probably not, but 2.5 and 17.5%. Right. Is that actually giving you any information?
Was it your Sika? Is it Sika or Seca? Sika?
Sika, yeah.
That's the one?
Yeah, the lab grade one was the Sika MBCA 515, which we do like, and it actually has well validated algorithms and such. So we were pretty surprised by some of these consumer devices that performed on par with it.
So that's interesting.
Which ones were looking at the kings?
Yeah, so of the consumer devices, I will answer your questions. I feel like I'm getting back. So that was kind of the one point in time. I'll just mention one other part of the study. So those 73 people we tested at one visit, they had the option to opt in to come back 12 to 16 weeks later and be assessed again. So about half the sample, 37 individuals, opted in for that. And we gave them no restrictions on what they did. So we're like, you can gain weight, you can lose weight, just do whatever you want. And we were just assuming natural variability would occur. And it did. It was kind of amazing. It was like right at 50%. Gained weight 50%, or sorry, gained body fat 50%, lost body fat. So we had this nice range, just kind of natural variation that occurred from people living their lives. And that allowed us to look at what the four compartment model showed the real change in body fat was over those 12 to 16 weeks and compare the change we saw with each other device.
That's
so
cool.
This was kind of the last piece of the puzzle we wanted because, as you all know, many individuals are interested in using these devices to track their changes over time, not just to know what their body fat is. So with all that said, we provided sort of a simplified global ranking where we ranked the scales first to 14th in both group level and individual level performance, both at one point in time and longitudinally, as well as reliability. So we had these kind of five domains, we ranked them, and then we got a global rank of everything overall. So I can tell you the best few consumer devices based on the overall ranking. We do have the full rankings in our manuscript, and that is freely available as well. But overall, so the top few came from some of these manufacturers that are more established in body composition testing, which I don't think is an accident at all. I think it means they have scientists that actually know how to put these regression equations together appropriately.
They're gonna recruit you. That's what they're gonna do.
Maybe we'll see.
Industry's coming for you.
Yeah. So the top one overall in our global ranking was the Omron HBF 516. So this was a device from Omron. This is one that had both the feet electrodes and the hand electrodes, which could have played into that. It was not only first overall, but it was first in the longitudinal validity, both for groups and individuals. So if you're looking at tracking for a consumer grade device, this one performed very well. The next two were actually both Tanita devices. So again, very established manufacturer. And again, I think that matters because looking at them and using my limited knowledge in this area, I don't think the hardware is that different. Like in terms of the electrodes they're using, in terms of just the nuts and bolts of what's there, I think it's largely how well the equations are developed and say internally validated. From the performance on the other end, the very, very poor performance, to me, it's clear some of these, I don't know how they came up with equations, but it's clear they didn't actually like test it in a real population of people, unless it was a tiny sample, just because the data just did not look reasonable, like what you'd expect if it's actually treating the biological data appropriately. So that's a side note. But yeah, so Omron HBS 516 was first ranked. Next was Tanita BC 568 InterScan. Then the third one was a Tanita, actually just a foot-to-foot Tanita.
Wow.
Tanita
yeah, there was no hand.
81, no, yeah, which was impressive. I was very surprised. Yeah. I think that one might be like a $60 device or something, and it was technically ranked just ahead of our, you know, $14,000-$15,000 lab grade device. And the lab grade device provides a lot more information, provides segmental data and all this, but nonetheless, it was a little surprising.
That's impressive.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. How do they calculate the muscle mass then? How do they tease out that out of the components?
So most of these do not give a muscle mass estimate.
Okay.
Some do. So like the Sika lab grade one.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
The reason they do is because they actually did like an MRI validation study where they collected biological data with this device, performed like MRI for skeletal muscle mass assessment, and then just built a regression or prediction equation.
Yeah, I was going to say, because in your four components and compartments, there's not specifically muscle mass, right?
It's in the other category, right?
Well, yeah, so that's a great question. So the four-compartment model and the two-compartment model, all of these are what we call molecular level assessments. So we're just trying to estimate the molecules in the body wherever they occur. So for example, when we're talking about molecular fat mass, which is what body fat percentage is calculated on, it doesn't matter if those molecules of fat are in adipose tissue or if they're intramuscular triglyceride or if they're somewhere else in the body. A different level that, of course, is important in other contexts is the organ tissue level assessment. That's where you'd have like adipose tissue that you could isolate anatomically, skeletal muscle that you could isolate anatomically. But within each of those tissues, like adipose tissue is mostly fat, but it does have some protein and water. Similarly, skeletal muscle has a lot of water and protein, but it has a little bit of lipid in it and so on. So yeah, everything we're talking about in this paper is all at the molecular level. None of these directly assess organ tissue entities like skeletal muscle, even though some do have the prediction equations they've made to kind of try to cross over between some of these levels.
God, that's so interesting. Some smart people, smart mathematicians.
Yeah.
Very cool. So what's your practical takeaway from this? Obviously, I mean, to me, from a consumer standpoint and from a physician standpoint, working with people with obesity and overweight too, not just, you know, obesity, but and assessing lifestyle and pharmacotherapy and surgery and that type of thing. It sounds like, hey, if you're going to track yourself at home, those top three scales are fair game. I mean, even compared to the research grade.
Yeah. So I would say, I guess my takeaways first is something we kind of touched on earlier, that I think this category is diverse enough, and we saw enough variability in performance across devices that might look similar from the outside. So my first takeaway is that this is not a homogenous category. There are some devices that might be worth considering and some that have the, you know, the bad stereotype is true about BIA scales being, you know, trash. Yeah. So some of them really were. The data was kind of worse than having nothing. But yeah, again, for those top performers, for those, I'd say there is still enough error to be cautious. It's hard to assess accurately in individuals. Like if you look at, you know, scatter plots from our study, you might be that awesome individual where you had a 3% body fat increase with a four compartment model and you had exactly a 3% increase with one of these BIA devices. There were some of those individuals like perfectly along this line of agreement. The hard thing is you just don't know for sure. Like if you're the consumer, you're not also getting your four compartment model assessed where you can verify. So I think even for the top performers, you have to interpret with caution. Just like we were talking about earlier, thinking about it in terms of a range. So looking at some of the, you know, air metrics, or like say for you all, if you're working with patients and had one of these devices and had 3% error, just like you're talking about, if they're starting at 30%, you're like, okay, you might be starting somewhere 27 to 33%. That can help you in the next time they're at 29%. You're like, okay, you know, that's be encouraged. Maybe this moving in the right direction, but you know, this is within the error of the device. So that might not be a true change. Now, once they're coming in at 25%, and of course they'll probably have seen other things that are encouraging them. But then you might feel a little more confident, especially if that's paired with like, okay, we see your waist circumference decreasing. We see your, you know, body mass overall decreasing. So that's how I'd view it. Like the top end is worth considering as one component of kind of a multifaceted monitoring approach.
The other question I have is, was there individual variance along the spectrum of, say, any of those markers, BMI, body fat, et cetera? I mean, did someone with a body fat percent of 50 have different results than someone with a body fat of 6?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And among the poor performing devices, we saw a lot of that. Something we call proportional bias, meaning that how accurate or inaccurate the device is varies based on the level of what you're assessing, which is body fat. So, you know, I'm looking at the graphs here. I'll pick out one of the bad devices. Maybe I won't name it here, but in leaner individuals, so say people who are down around 15% body fat, it was overestimating substantially. So like many individuals being overestimated by 10%+ body fat if they're lean. But once you got up into individuals with higher body fat, so I'm looking at the other end of the spectrum that's up above 40% body fat, they were being underestimated by about 10% body fat.
Oh, wow.
So this relationship where it matters a lot where you fall on the spectrum. Now, the better devices don't have that dramatic relationship. They have kind of a steady relationship across body fat levels, which is one of the big performance things we
that is interesting. Devices. Spencer, do you remember going to some of these conferences where they were selling these and we tried them and then we were all bent out of shape because they were a lot higher body fat estimate for us than what our, say, DEXAs and bod pods and stuff were? Do you remember that?
Yours was, because you have like negative 3% body fat. Mine was about, you know, mine was about 12%, I think.
Was it really? I mean, because I always, you know, generally had single digits depending on what's part of my life.
My brother had abs and utero, so I don't know.
I remember with those devices that they're selling to physicians, I was like, I don't know, it was like 15, 17.
Yeah, but you're on you're an extreme example. I mean, like, yeah, mine was like 12 or 14.
Well, but that's why I asked.
Somewhere around there.
So then that makes sense, maybe, even for some of those at the conferences. But
yeah, but you were on like the Sika, I think it was the Sika thing.
I don't even remember. I'll tell you, that's one thing that certainly turned me off from these. And, you know, kind of going from our clinical perspective, for people with obesity and obesity complications, you know, that's how we really stage the severity of disease. You know, do they have pre-diabetes, diabetes, sleep apnea, fatty liver, all that stuff, we do that clinically anyways, right? And so, you know, if you look at our 2016 guidelines, which we're going to update the algorithm, we talked about using BMI in the context of a clinical exam. Like we can tell if someone's muscular and lean or if they have excess adipose tissue. And then we use a waist circumference to help refine the cardiometabolic risk. And then most of the time, though, for us, for our patients, I don't know that knowing the exact body composition would help from our perspective. On the other hand,
sarcopenia
is probably a spectrum, which kind of goes back to my other question, but includes sarcopenia.
I think it's more for tracking, though.
Right. So this
I think
is
it's
what
tracking.
We're talking about really is more for individuals, and would it benefit them? And I don't really know the answer to that, to be honest.
I think for tracking. So just from a practical standpoint, people get upset when they, especially if they're exercising and things, they don't see the scale moving mm-hmm. as fast, but there's a kind of a body recomposition yeah. thing that it's one more which measure is as Dr. Tinsley was talking about. He gets all the circumferences yeah. and some people don't see the scale moving, but they can see their yeah. clothes fitting differently yeah. and their circumferences. And then, you know, if you have one more little measure such as this, I think based on their study, you know, the best one was like, what, $200 or $300. That's well, it makes yeah, I mean, it's perfect as a Christmas gift yeah, for your
even
spouse.
One was no, only kidding, $60. Probably, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is definitely not the best for individuals out there who want spouses. To use this than what I previously, you know, thought. So this is, you know, really
yeah, and I don't disagree. We were definitely pleasantly surprised by the top end of performance. I will say that bottom end of performance is still there. So, you know, listener, don't take this as oh, just any old right. body fat yeah. scale. Just go to Walmart, pick one out. That might be okay or it might not. Some of the poor performers were way, way off, where it would probably provide more, you know, confusion than good. So that's why we wanted to do this. And I hope to continue this line of research, you know, like as new devices come out,
yeah.
to try to provide some, you know, updated guidance. Not that most consumers will get this information, but no. hopefully some of it can be disseminated to those yeah. such as yourselves who can help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a big deal because yeah. I've always kind of poo-pooed it all, to be honest. And yeah. so this at least provides us with some good, you know, information for people out there. Hey, if you want to do this, there are a few that are, you know, at least reliable.
Yeah, I get asked yeah. now. So we're going to put the blog that you wrote because it goes into depth and the whole mm-hmm. chart of the different ranked scales. So I'll put that in the show notes for anybody listening. Again, if you know you're interested in tracking this, it's something worth reading. And then he also goes into more depth of the compartments, the four compartments. It gives a very good little table there. We thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Tinsley. It was like we're learning yeah. too, because I mean, again, we did this. I did exercise science in undergrad and did all the calipers like my brother did.
It's been a while.
It's
beyond our level.
Yeah, it goes way. It went way beyond our little undergrad yeah. Classes. Yeah. That we
oh, this
took.
Was great. Really learned.
Yeah,
a lot.
Thank you.
Well, no,
so
thank
much.
You. Yeah, I was happy to connect with you both. I appreciate you having me on. I've followed you both online for a long time, so try not perfect. To fanboy too much. But I'm nice. I'm excited to be chatting
that's
with
cool.
you.
So. Yeah, we'll probably talk with you more offline yeah. about we're trying to do a study looking at body composition of, yep. of something. So
yep, you're already
yeah,
on
I'm probably
going
to chat with you. Just yeah, we're you're already yeah you are on the paper. You don't even know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it.
Very cool. Thank you so much. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.